Hello and welcome to the Conscious Consulting Podcast, where we will introduce you to the Conscious Consulting philosophy. Together with our senior advisors from all around the world, we blend the deep knowing of wisdom traditions, technology, modern science, and business, and show you how to transform this wisdom into impact in your daily life as a consultant, leader, or entrepreneur. Welcome to the CCG community.
Again, welcome everyone to our event Leading at the Edge of the Known. And my name is Julia Schulen, and together with Christian Mayhofer and Surya Tahora, we are hosting this event today. And it's a co-production of Conscious Consulting Group and the SP Jain Institute of Management in Mumbai. And this is also where Surya is sitting. So Christian and I, we are the founding partners of Conscious Consulting Group. And Surya is a professor of science and of spirituality. And he's also the executive director of the Center for Wisdom and Leadership at the Jain Institute in Mumbai. But actually, we met him in a conference in Hungary. So
correct.
Very international. You are also teaching and working in Europe quite a lot. So Surya's focus areas include Eastern philosophy, meditative practices, cognitive neurosciences, personal growth and ethics, especially in leadership development. He's working with students and business leaders. So thank you all very much for being here. And Surya, the stage is yours. Thank you.
Wow. Wonderful. Thank you, Julia and Christian, for inviting me and organizing this event. The introduction, I will make it short. I think in the announcement that Julia and Christian posted, and the title says it all. So I need not elaborate on this. I think the idea that this question captures is something that it seems to us in this modern day, which is like with all these technological disruptions and markets and political uncertainty and events and polarization and whatever. I mean, there is a huge list of things that we in the modern day, we say, oh, you know, our era is like unprecedented and so on. But what is interesting are two things. One is that any person who is feeling that he is living in this world and the tone or the atmosphere or the emotional landscape which is around this kind of, let's say, readings or news or media or narrative, it makes it a little bit daunting. And then I would say it makes it like, oh God, what I will do? So then if you're a leader, wherever you are in consulting or in an organization, you find it that now is the end of the world and what I will do and so on, right? So you find yourself helpless and a little bit at the edge of some precipice and you will fall into that. So some other narrative could be, oh, it's very exciting. And you have some people who are like not speaking about the ills of modern era, but they are saying, wow, this is so exciting. I want to be part of these changes and so on. Right, so you have this these two kind of reaction in leaders and everyone, in fact, to this narrative. The second thing, which is for me more important, is that it seems that it's really unique to our modern age, but in fact, it's not. Right, we all know that in previous times, also there were these huge shifts. I'm reading now a book on Marcus Aurelius. Okay, this emperor Stoic. Philosopher, emperor and philosopher. And during his reign, he had to face everything from wars, of course, and plagues and so on, and rivalry inside, which is like very common. And he had to face all this treason and these plots and so on, and also demands for justice. And it was also at the time of shift because the Christian also were beginning to, let's say, emerge and so on. So there are many stages in history that there have been these big shifts or even like this uncertainty, right? So it's not like unique problem, really speaking, right? The nature of the problem may be different, but the fact that there are things which are unknown to us and which are uncertain and unpredictable, this is not known. This is also the lot of any human being 10,000 years ago. And I would say he was maybe even in a more daunting situation than us in the modern area, where to some extent we are like safeguarded from some, let's say, basic safety and health, let's say, kind of predicament, even though that's not totally true. Okay. Now, the third point, which is interesting, is that if this question or this idea of problems of known, unknown, uncertain, unpredictable, complex is not novel, it means also that humanity, through the 200,000 years that you are human, have been thinking about this question. And they have been thinking in different cultures, right? From, again, the Greek Stoics, as I've been seeing, to the sages in India, to anywhere on the planet, there is this fundamental question, which is at the heart of philosophy or religion or whatever you call it, like deep reflective existential question. And not only they have reflected, but they have proposed some insights on that. Okay. And my take is that this wisdom tradition, wherever they come from, they give us some ways to navigate this complexity, this like problem of not knowing what is happening next minute. I'm not speaking about next month or next 6 months after Trump will come and after what happened to Ukraine and Gaza and so on. I think we can very much benefit from this wisdom tradition. Okay. So now I will not give you a panorama of all what wisdom tradition are saying. This is not my expertise. My expertise, and I am also, in addition to what Julia says, I'm also teaching Indian philosophy, in particular Advaita Vedanta. Okay, so I will explain what it is briefly. You will see where I'm coming from. And what I think and what I suggest to you now is to revisit some of these insights of Advaita Vedanta, right? And that could maybe guide our path and resonate with our, let's say, kind of helplessness or our sense of, wait, what is it, our interrogation of what is it that I have to do with that? Okay. So Advaita Vedanta is known. Advaita means non-dual. Okay. And Vedanta means it's a set of teaching which is like found in the Vedas, at the end of the Vedas. And they are like looking into these perennial existential questions, okay, which is including this idea of uncertainty, of mortality, of suddenness of things, of complexity, and so on, right? The emphasis for Advaita Vedanta is on the one thing, which is, and I will elaborate and start by this point, which I think is important to understand well first. There is all that is here in this universe. So that includes objects, things, events, people, inner things, living things, from plant to bacteria, to human beings, to animals, to rivers, to mountains, to galaxies, to stars, to sun and moon, all that is here. And all the events which are happening, which can be natural events or events which are triggered by human beings, all that is here is a part of a grand order of things, a grand web of things. So in order, don't take it as something determined and fixed. Take it rather as a web, okay? And a web, an order means a complex web of relationship, which is like stretching in all directions and dynamically changing in time, constantly changing. Every second, this web is changing. And in this web, if we take a metaphor which is there in the Veda and then taken further by the Buddhist and the Chinese Buddhist also schools, there is a metaphor of the web of Indra. So they are jewels and which are all linked by threads. And this forms an amazing web. And this web is not static, it's changing all the time. Okay. So this is a metaphor. What does this metaphor say? Okay. It says that if you take each jewel for either an individual or a quantum particle or for a galaxy or for a local cluster of galaxies, you see the different levels at which I am speaking about these jewels, right? It's not just at one level. You from the micro to the meso to the macro, all these jewels are interconnected and interdependent. and mutually influence each other. So this is the first thing, right? This order of things, this grand cosmic web or order of things, is governed by some laws which apply at different levels. So physical is the most, let's say, immediately easily understood, right? But you can say also life, okay, biological. So there are physical laws, there are biological laws, there are ecological laws, there are sociological laws, economical laws, financial laws. There are all laws also governing, let's say, even finance, if you want to speak business, right? How so all these laws in various domains, from quantum physics to astrophysics, right? And in between all these different disciplines that the human have come to, let's say, develop, what are they doing exactly? They are trying to have a glimpse into the functioning of all these laws of cause and effect. What is the cause? And this cause will produce an effect, maybe now, maybe in 2 weeks, maybe much later. First element. Second thing, the cause can also percolate either down or up. The virus, for example, the COVID virus, which starts down at the quantum, at the, let's say, molecular level or atomic level, these effects are trickled up all over and have like disrupted the entire globe. And you have also some other events like wars. We will also trickle down where? In our minds and in our hearts. So you have ascendant causality, you have descendant causality, you have a causality where the time, there can be a time lag between a cause and an effect, right? Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, and then what is the cumulative, let's say, effect of all this is what we're facing now with climate change and so on, right? But the crux is what? Nothing happens in isolation, right? And any action or any which is a cause will become a cause, will trickle ripples in this web and all over, right? So this is the idea, okay? Now, because of this intricacy of this web, it is, of course, very complex to decipher, right? We think that everything can be predictable, and we all know with how we have faced, let's say, life, that it's not, everything is not linear and predictable, right? And now, this is what you have to understand. This is the context where we operate. Okay? So there have been recently a lot of, let's say, talk about VUCA and SPAMI and whatever, which are giving us a glimpse into that. But what you have to understand here, what Vedanta has been saying this for 10,000 years, and also second, what they are saying is not just this complexity, uncertainty, and so on. They're saying that there is a whole here. There is one reality, underlying reality, which is governing, which is permeating, which is informing, which is pervading everything in the form of a grand intelligence, okay? So what is the idea of Vedanta? It's a little bit like for those who are familiar with the logos of Stoicism, okay? This universal order of the logos, right? There is a universal logos and individual logos. So how can I, and this is also what Vedanta is saying, how can I be aligned, okay, with the tide? How can I be aligned with this, right? With this dynamic and constantly changing things. That is why if my posture is that of rigidity and fixation and control, right? If I have to confront reality, it will not work. So the whole now purpose of Vedanta is show us how to align ourselves with that, which will lead to an existence which will be joyful, light, efficient, and so on. Okay. Now, further, what Vedanta is saying is very interesting. It's saying, let's start by human being. Okay. And what to make it very simple, right? Who are you as a human? What are the different facets of being a human? Okay. One's facet is that we are acting, right? We are a karta. In Sanskrit, it's called the karta, okay? A doer, right? a doer. So a karta is a doer. And the second is what? We're a bhokta. Okay? And bhokta, I will translate by enjoyer or experiencer. Okay? So let's go a little bit further in defining these words because they are important. Okay? Karta is a doer means what? I have the sense that I am doing this action. This is what constitutes a karta, a doer, right? The sense of doership, right? I am a karta. I am the author of this action and not that action. And this action belongs to me. Okay? I initiated it. Okay? And of course, I will be responsible. But that is secondary, right? This is the karta. The second facet of a human being is what? He's a bhokta, right? So what does it mean, bhokta? A bhokta can be translated literally, it's an enjoyer. So enjoyer of what, right? We all have the sense that I experience the results of my own action first, okay? I initiate some action and it's all in order to enjoy result or the result of the action that I initiated, right? This is a bhokta. Now, you see how the translation of bhokta into enjoyer can lead to some problem because enjoying means enjoying something which is pleasant, right? Which is joyful. And what we are confronted to, whether it's the result of our own action or when I am the recipient of all the multiple kartas which are around me, or even as we saw, some global, let's say, kind of events which happen, that wars, which are accumulated action of societies or nation and so on, or natural disasters, I am in that posture also what? Not an enjoyer, I am an experiencer. So that's why I prefer to translate bhokta by experiencer. I am the recipient and I am the one who is getting through the experience of this. So this is a posture of bhokta. The other one where I am engaging and acting is a posture of a karta. Okay? Now, if this is clear, now we can proceed further. There is one very nice text that we have studied, that is studied in Vedanta philosophy, in Indian philosophy, which is called Yoga Vashishta. In Yoga Vashishta, there is a sage who is called Vashishta, who is teaching a young prince. Okay? And he's very young at that age, he's not even 18. It is Rama. So if you have heard about Ramayana, Rama is going to be the future, let's say, king or emperor of a huge kingdom, right? And what Vashishta is teaching Rama is what? A, look at this, let's say, give up all the doubts and remain clear about this context in which you will be acting and experiencing things. And after having this, like totally assimilated in you, become a Mahakarta, a great doer, and become a Mahabhokta, a great experiencer. Okay? So what is this sage Vashishta telling Rama is that, hey, maybe you can grow from becoming, from being now a common Karta, an ordinary Karta, to become a great Karta. A great doer, for a simple, let's say, doer to a great doer, and from a simple experiencer, enjoyer, to a great experiencer. Okay, so what is this exactly? Okay, so let's look at this. Okay, let's start by the bhokta. Okay, what is an ordinary experiencer of things? Okay, so what is it? Moment after moment, things are unfolding, right? Now, what is it that that we can distinguish here? There are several types of experiencer, right? The first type of bhokta, right, is what? I am looking for this happy and pleasant experience and so on, and I want only this. All the rest, which is unpleasant and I don't want to go into. I resist to this, right? I have a sharp resistance and refusal towards what is painful and unpleasant. Natural, right? Okay. So there is a clear demarcation between that, what I like, what I want to happen, and what will make me joyful and what I don't like at all, right? What I refuse to happen and which will make me unhappy. Okay. So you see that if you're governed only by this, let's say, polarities, and which are strong, what will happen? Okay, what will happen? At the center of a life of this simple karta, a bhokta, there is what? What will make me feel great, and what can be a threat to my happiness and to my pleasures? The dominant feeling, if we speak about emotion, is what? Hope. There is hope, and I do things to have this, enjoy this result and pleasant result. So there is hope. There is expectation, but which is almost at the borderline of a demand. I want this to happen absolutely, and therefore there is fear, because the context being what it is, as we have seen, and anxiety, and a general sense of insecurity. Okay. You see this daunting feeling that the people have in modern time? Not new, okay? Not new, usual. So you see that, okay? So there is an oscillation, therefore, between high periods of elation, right? And depression. When you get what you want and what you like, up, down, okay? So what will happen? The ordinary bhokta will be prone to what? To overreact and to react when things do not go its way. There will be blame, there will be anger, resentment, and so on, and some coping strategies. So there's drugs and whatever, and drinking and whatever, denial, distraction. You see, you can apply this even in the modern context, right? It's very interesting to see that it illumines also this modern contemporary context, right? Now, whatever seems to alleviate my suffering temporarily, I go into that, right? But they don't address the root cause, right? What is the root cause? The root cause, I am not identifying, so therefore I'm entangled further because of my attitude and my perspective of life and what I am confronting, right? Therefore, then slowly this bhokta evolves into a in between, not yet a Mahabhokta, not yet a Maha-experiencer, a great experiencer, but he begins to develop some psychological and contemplative maybe practices to develop some inner space, right? This is why all these meditative practices are coming, to become aware of what is happening in me, the story I tell myself, and the result on my emotional landscape and the interplay of my thoughts, my belief, my mindset about the universe, about me, the interplay between all these mindset and stories and my emotion, my bodily sensation, and my behavior, right? And as I become more aware of this, I also become aware of one thing, which is what? That life is not exempt from pain. In fact, life is a mix of what is called sukha and dukkha, right? And this is what is life is about. Nobody can be exempt from that. If you accept this in your perspective of you in the world, you are, let's say, you are doomed, right? You will not be comfortable living, right? So denying the unpleasant is not a way, let's say, to go and to live, because you will cut yourself from the realities of life, right? Second, the second small insight that this shifting the journey from Bhokta to Mahabhokta is that the external changes, right, are, let's say, they are born a moment, they stay for a while, and then they will decline and go. The changes are not there always to stay, right? This is the whole thing of so many wisdom tradition about this impermanence that Buddhist tradition has spoken so much about, right? So then, third level is now going further. There are cause and effects which govern all what is happening, right? My action and the action of others are intertwined to lead to all this what is happening in me from recent past, distant past, and all this culminates into what I am now doing, right? So I get now this bhokta in transition is getting a glimpse into the working of this like hidden so-called orders or laws, right? So this is the idea. And it comes slowly to understand one thing which is important is that whatever is in my hand and depends upon me is my action. But there are so many innumerable factors, given the complexity of this web, of cause and effect, which is changing all the time. I cannot control the outcome nor dictate whatever will happen to me, right? So big insight, which is beginning to come, right? But then what is this Mahakata? Because this intermediate transition, let's say Bokta, sorry, is still like falling back into his ordinary or common, let's say, perspective of life and way of reacting. So the Mahabhokta is very interesting because now he's more alive to this order. The insight or the assimilation of this and this change of perspective is fully integrated, right? So a dynamic, complex, intelligent order, bringing together actions from me, from others, okay? There is also the psychological order, laws of cause and effect, which make me feel that way. And it is human and it is natural. I need not be afraid of my own emotion, right? There is an order there. There is a law there. It's okay. It has its place, right? So even when this person is experiencing insecurity, right? Or pleasure, then she's able to, let's say, manage better this emotional upheavals, right? And this Mahabhokta has now a stable and is deeply anchored in herself, right? The space between the freedom between what is happening in the body, mind, emotion, and so on is like so clear that it's not, she's or he is not anymore overwhelmed by what is happening, right? Now, more cheerful, more enthusiastic, sensitive to beauty and empathetic, but at the same time, not denying that I can experience also sadness. I can experience, let's say, doubt. I can experience hopelessness, helplessness, but not anymore drawn to this. Okay. So this is the idea here, right? So like totally, let's say, flowing into what is happening. But a bhokta by itself is not complete. You understand that it has to be now brought together with the other side of the human, which is a doer. So what are the characteristics again of now a common or ordinary, let's say, doer, right? What is it? That's very interesting. Now, what is an ordinary karta, right? A common karta is acting, right, while he was being like an ordinary bhokta, overwhelmed by situation and inner pressures, right? I want this to happen. I don't want this to happen. And there is a demand, a strong pressure coming from inside, right? So we can say that this first level of a karta is characterized by reaction and not action. It's not deliberate action. Right? With this pressure of dislikes and dislikes and longing and, let's say, preferences and hatred and resentment. I mean, there is a mechanical, again, like the bhokta, right? Impulsive and fraught with a lot of subjectivity, right? And fear, which is governing his choice of action, right? And what is happening in that case, right? As I grow, what is happening? My action becomes what? Less, let's say, governed by these strong desires and aversions. It's not that I don't have them anymore. I have some desires and some preferences. I have some things I don't like. But now the question is not anymore what is there in for me, right? But it is what? It's not anymore what do I feel like doing. It is what will I do, which has to be done and which is appropriate in this situation. What ripples my action will trigger in this vast web of interconnectedness, right? So this is the idea. And now in transition, the karta now becomes more aware and asks himself some questions, right? What is expected of me in a given situation? And for this given role, given that I am playing so many different roles, as a boss, as an employer, as a son, as a daughter, as a mother, as a friend, as a member of a community, as a citizen, etc., etc. And these roles are fluid. And for each of them, there is something which is called for. So look at this now. Descartes is beginning to play a dance. A dance which is a fluid dance. Sometimes he comes back to being again governed by the pressure of his likes and dislikes. But now he's like graduating and slowly transitioning, transforming himself, right? Now he can be again still depending upon some norms of the family, the community. There is not, let's say, total freedom here. But he's more and more emancipating himself or herself, let's say, from these norms, right? This immediate interest, this like preoccupation with only me and what is there here. And I go beyond the fear also of transgressing authorities and norms, right? This is very, this is the beginning of some freedom. I act from dignity. I act from my own values, which are in touch with the web. Because whatever I do to the web, I do to others and I do to myself, right? I am not anymore like a child who wants, who live in this separate thing and wants absolutely these things, right? So there is a widening of the whole perspective, right? And what is happening is that the third level where the karta becomes a mahakarta, and I will finish there, a mahakarta is there. Of course, there will be the likes and dislikes, preferences, and some aversions, but they are becoming less binding. It means I am not like under the spell of them, right? I'm able to pause and reflect and see what I can do. What does this see? Is this in accordance with my values and how it will affect the other, right? So there is not anymore some control impulsivity or uncontrolled impulsivity anymore, right? But there is a true freedom in action. This is the Mahakarta, right? There is almost a kind of spontaneous aligning with this great web, right? And so this is the experience of the Mahakarta is what, hey, there is no more choice or doubt or deliberation needed. Spontaneously, I see that there is one action possible and just flow. Okay, so this is the a simple division of what is a way of looking at the human from two perspectives, a karta, right? Focusing on his personal goals, immediate objective, tangible results, right? And but not at all aware of the broader impact of his action, right? And it can the Mahakarta, as you have understood, is acting consciously and in accordance with some universal values and being part of a greater whole, right? So you can see that he will be adept in adaptive problem solving. He will know what is in my sphere of influence and what is not, what is known to me and what is not known to me, right? And what will remain anyway unknown. And of course, dharma, which is the word for ethics in Indian philosophy, is quite clear. I am ensuring, as a Mahakarta, that my action do not harm any living beings, right? Or society at large, right? And he aims to what? To support and nurture, make the whole thing flourish, wherever he is, small community or family or big company or society, if he has the sphere of influence, right? So this is the idea from Karta to Mahakarta. My bread and butter is not only to show you what this Indian wisdom or whatever wisdom is saying, but then how to translate it into action, right? So here, your question, if I understand well, is that what is it that in this context of a company, right, will enable people to flourish? So I will say straight from my experience, one thing is that, of course, you can take individual, let's say, initiative within a company, right? But of course, the risk is that you will be at some point, if your company is not totally, let's say, at the level of consciousness, of growth, or maturity that you have, you will feel some disconnect at some point or the other. If you can manage this, it's okay. But there is a problem here, right? Now, my experience says that If really we want to shift from this ordinary, let's say, or common mode to a more, let's say, mature and more evolved mode, it has to come from the top. Okay? There is already a lot of, let's say, change or a call for change, which is coming from down, right? But if you address the problem from down without addressing it in the change of what the leader at the top of are doing and demonstrating it and committing themselves, including their own transformation to this work, it will not work. It will fail, right? I'm sure it's your experience, or maybe you have some other experience, but many, I have seen some project initially where I was involved, where the CEOs and the CXOs were not involved. They were just sending their people for some training. Oh, mindfulness, very good, right? And then what? Then it becomes totally instrumental, right? Instrumental in making a toxic culture or organization to some extent or the other continue, right? And at the same time, now you are teaching your people to be able to cope with the toxicity, right? Through mindfulness. Oh, now I am aware of how I am. So that doesn't produce this lasting transformation, let's say, of the company and the individual. So first, starting by the top. Yeah.
Amit, thank you. So first of all, Amit, among various of your topics, the one struck me most actually in the beginning that when you made the distinction of we are not unique in terms of the experience, this feeling in the in between and the pressure at the threshold is a human experience throughout. We exist as human beings. This is
Exactly.
somehow soothing to me, and it takes out the uniqueness of our polarized realities which we face. So this
Yeah.
is very good to hear also from a historical context
Yes.
standpoint. What I really often see is because just coming back, what you just answered Peter's question of what do you do if you well, don't have immediate or direct access to the
Yeah.
C-level, and you are
Yes.
kind of engaged in kind of, for instance, one below, which
Yes.
is can be already really be significant, you know, for large
Yeah.
corporations. You are one direct to the board this is a massive leadership role. So how do you
Yes.
act then? What do you see from your experience background, or would be your proposal to or an advice you give?
Yeah. So yeah, of course, the board is another thing, right? The board, not only the leaders have to be in, but many of the decisions are taken also by the board and through the board. So the board also has to be, let's say, going into that, right? So the simple logic I've been, I mean, using, and I'm sure you're doing that as well, is that, see, you have to tie it somehow to some longevity or long-term economic, let's say, benefits. Then they will listen. The board will listen, and the CEO, of course, will execute whatever the board is saying, will listen, right? So I think that the key is to be able to manage this kind of, let's say, way through an organization. It's not easy, right? It's not easy because the board also has like a different kind of conflicting and all these individuals who are different perspectives on things. And they might not be all, let's say, evolved enough to adhere to this. And they will be focused only on metrics, right? On, for example, metrics and all these financial metrics. And that's all what matters for me. This is how Emmanuel Faber, the head of Danone, was ousted by the board under the pressure of some minority shareholders who are holding, let's say, this pension fund from US. And they say, no, it's very good. You are a business corporation now. You have evolved as a company and so on. You are doing so much, let's say, more conscious to take let's say, kind of work as a company in the social space, taking care of your people, taking care of this logistics and outsourcing and suppliers and whatever. But then what? Hey, that my interest is not this. Will that deliver the short term, let's say, financial result? And what happened in the case of Faber is that, unfortunately, at this time, it was a little bit in a fragile, let's say, context. And they took opportunity of this to house it down, right? Because the dominant thing is what? Just financial metrics. So the idea here, what is the alternative, right? Is to tell, what do I do here? What is the alternative? I'm just looking at some notes that I've taken to give you an example here. How can we still, let's say, cultivate, let's say, a widened kind of picture and perspective, right? So here the idea is really according, entering into how do you embed dharma or ethics? Really speaking, it's about ethics and a long-term vision perspective, right? So how do you do that, right? So there are some possibilities. Okay, that you can do at the individual level. Now, see, in all this question, you have always to distinguish individual level and organization level. At individual level, the question that you can ask yourself when you are about to make a choice, okay, of spending X millions of euro or in a project and relocating all your, let's say, value chain element in one site, all right, for example. Or make sure that there are some environmental disruptions. So every time you are about to make an important choice, can I check if I am avoiding, let's say, harm? Harm to any of the stakeholders, right? See, if you are living in a web of, let's say, interconnected, let's say, and interdependent stakeholders, the harm you do to the nature ultimately will come back to you. This is what happened to Coca-Cola. When they came to India, they forgot totally what? They were tapping all the water to bottle their Coca-Cola. And that was 30, 40 years ago. And then what happened? All the communities around, they were deprived of water. And what do you think happened at that time? Right? They were hosted by the government, right? So every time I have to make a choice, which is beneficial in the short term, but not in the long term, I ask myself a question. Is it nurturing or is it, let's say, harming things, right? Harming one of the stakeholders, right? Who can be affected by this decision? Can it harm anyone even indirectly, right? So there is one, other way, let's say, to look at this, am I not just not harming? See, now, one thing is not harming, but the other way is that more positive, right? Am I supporting or uplifting the communities around me? If the guy at Coke had asked himself this question, he would not have done what he has done. He has not asked himself this question. Am I supporting or uplifting?